This morning, we began to define what I think can be a very useful term for us as we think about all that is contained in the death and resurrection of the Lord. We use the term Paschal Mystery, the way this has evolved in theological talk. And it's a way of saying all at once, the one huge deed of God, that is the suffering, death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus, the sending of the Spirit, and the founding of the church. We call that the hour of Jesus, this huge deed of God. And this huge deed of God reveals, in fact, who God is, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and what God's intentions for the world are, namely that we should have communion and participation in divine life. In this afternoon's conference, I'd like to say a little bit more about this terminology. Briefly, something about the word mystery, and a little bit more about the word paschal. The word mystery in the theological tradition of Christianity does not mean that which you can't understand, so stop thinking about it. It doesn't mean that. The way in which we use this word comes to us from St. Paul. It's one of St. Paul's key words that he uses at particularly important moments. I think one of the best places where he speaks about it, the word, is in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 at verse 7, where he's speaking about the cross of Christ, and he says, "None of the rulers of this age knew the mystery. Otherwise, they would have never crucified the Lord of glory." The word mystery does mean, in Greek, something hidden, something we don't know. And none of the rulers of this age knew who it was, who Jesus was. In fact, he is the Lord of glory, and they put him to death. Not a good response to the Lord of glory. Okay, so none of the rulers of this age knew the mystery. St. Paul also speaks about mystery as something that he has been entrusted with, hidden in times past, but now revealed, namely that Gentiles are co-heirs with the Jews in the promises of God. This too is called mystery. In my book, What Happens at Mass, gathering a number of St. Paul's texts on mystery together, I gave what seems to be a kind of a useful definition for people of mystery. I say the way St. Paul means it, it's a concrete something that when you bump into it, you encounter God. So a concrete something, the cross of Christ, you don't expect it. God is hidden there, but really there. A concrete something, the death and resurrection of Jesus. What's hidden there? The Gentiles are now co-heirs with the Jews. For this reason, Christians very early on began to call the Christological meaning of the Old Testament text, namely, how does the Old Testament text, in fact, actually speak about Jesus? They call that the mystery of the text. And the mystery of the text was to discover what the mystery of the text is to discover Christ as the subject matter of all the Old Testament texts. They also use the word mystery, by extension, for the sacramental celebrations. And in Roman Catholicism, we still call the sacraments, also we call them mysteries. Roman Catholics will recognize that Mass begins with the priest's exhortation, "Brothers and sisters, let us acknowledge our sins and so prepare ourselves to celebrate the sacred mysteries." We're talking about concrete somethings in which is hidden divine life. That's the sense of the word mystery. So if we combine that word with the adjective paschal, what we're saying is, what is the concrete something that is hidden in the suffering and death of Jesus. And what is hidden in that is that the crucified is risen and totally glorified and ascended and living through the Spirit in us. That's the mystery. In ages past, unknown, but now in these last days, revealed. So, now I want to say more about the word Pasch and Paschal. This is chapter 2 of my book, so it's right at the beginning of my book, more or less, after it, which followed the conference that I gave this morning. And I want to explain to you why I think this word is so important for our understanding, and that it's really worth knowing. I wish we used it more in English, and we can if we want. So, the word Pasch is the noun, and Paschal is the adjective. And they derive from the Aramaic form of the Hebrew word Pescha, which is what we translate in English as Passover. But in Greek, which was making in Greek a Greek word from the Hebrew text. All languages do that. It's just a word in another language. In Greek, this comes out as Pascha. And Latin took this word, Latin Christianity, took this word from Greek and said it the same way, Pascha. So that's originally a Hebrew word that is translated into Greek Christianity and Latin Christianity as Pascha. And it referred to what we in English call the Passover. Okay? And we know what that is. That's the great Jewish feast. It's the great Jewish feast that celebrates the Exodus from Egypt and the passing over the Red Sea into the desert to arrive at Sinai. All that is called Passover in English. I'm just letting you know what it's called in Greek and Latin. The same thing in Greek and Latin is called Pascha. Now, here we are speaking our languages. If we were speaking a Romance language, Spanish, Italian, French, Portuguese, and we wanted to speak about the Jewish Passover, we would have a word that sounds like Pascha. Pac, Pasqua, Pasqua. Okay? That's how you'd talk about the Jewish Passover. Pascha. How do you say Easter in those languages? Pascha. Same word. So, look, in English, we don't have the same word for what we call Easter. In English, we have a word Passover, and we think we're talking about a Jewish feast. And we are. We have a different word called Easter, and we think that's a specifically Christian feast, and it's about the resurrection of Jesus. And that is what the word has come to mean in English. Easter means resurrection. But Pascha, in all those languages, means a lot more than resurrection. So we need this word back in English so that we can see that the suffering, death, resurrection, ascension, and glorification of Christ is called Pascha, or if you will, Passover, meaning all that. So this is, think it through now. A lot is lost for us in English by this double terminology. In the Romance languages and in Latin and Greek, for Jew and Christian alike, in all these languages, they were all celebrating Pascha. And as such, the term could include a great deal. It could mean the Jewish feast. And Christians meant by it the celebration of the death and resurrection of Christ. which was an event that not by accident, but by the understanding of a deep divine providence, was an event that occurred inside the Jewish feast. Jesus' death and resurrection happened during, we say this all the time and you're used to it, happened during Passover. But I just want to say, Jesus' death and resurrection happened during Pascha. And as such, what Christians thought of was happening in the Jewish feast was seen now to be but a prophecy of something greater. The Jewish feast was a prophecy of Jesus' Pascha. What's that? Of his death and resurrection. That's, just to say it in English the way we might before, that's Passover fulfilled. Okay? But if I use the word Passover in English, you must hear Pascha behind it, okay? Otherwise, we can't think theology. I'll say Easter, and you'll only think of him being risen. But no one in the ancient world, in Greek or Latin, said Pascha without thinking of both death and resurrection at the same time. Okay? It's a word that does both at the same time. So, you see that we Catholics have the most important liturgy of the year is what we celebrate on the night of Saturday before the Sunday of Resurrection. And we call that the Easter Vigil. But in Latin, that would be called the Vigilia Paschale, the Paschal Vigil. And one of the subplots of my little book is after I explain this, is I stop calling it the Easter Vigil. And I insist on calling it the Paschal Vigil. Well, what's the difference? What difference does it make? If you call it the Easter Vigil, you're geared toward thinking that the whole ceremony is about resurrection. But if you look at the ceremony, you'll see the whole ceremony. We think that we misread the Holy Week and the liturgies. We think that it moves in a straight line. Like on Holy Thursday, it's the Mass of the Lord's Supper, and we don't know what's happening, but we'll just close our eyes and pretend that we're just having nice supper with Jesus. And then, next day he gets killed. Ooh, now what's going to happen? This is bad. And then, surprise, he's risen. No, we know the whole story when we start on Thursday. And we remember it in bits and pieces, but all of the liturgies move in circles. Circles in which resurrection is always present, and in which death is always present, even in resurrection. And Pasch and Paschal are terms that let us say this, the concentric circles. This is a preliminary in my book to reading carefully the way the biblical texts are arranged in the Paschal Triduum, which we Catholics tend to call the Easter Triduum. But no, it should be called the Paschal Triduum, because its subject is not moving in a linear way toward resurrection, but in a circular way, recalling all of these dimensions. So Pascha was the feast of the Lord's death and resurrection. And I can say it naturally in Italian, Buona Pasqua. And it's just like that, more or less, I think, in Spanish. But Buona Pasqua. But we're saying that already on Holy Thursday. We're saying it already on Good Friday. We're saying it all through the Easter season, Buona Pasqua. That's great. Imagine if I said to you on Good Friday, Happy Easter. Doesn't quite work. But it should. We want one word for that reality, because our most ancient traditions have one word for that. We could say that Pascha then was the feast of the Lord's death and resurrection, one feast. One feast celebrated in a triduum, that is to say, one feast celebrated in three intense days in which the paschal reality is moving differently in three intense days. Three intense days which bring us to the resurrection and then the paschal season, which goes for 50 days of Pascha. So we say it's Easter for 50 days, but I wish we could say and have it mean as much, it's Pasch for 50 days. Now, I know the language is not going to change. English, Easter is a great word and all that, and who doesn't love the word Easter? But if we want to do some theological thinking, we need to be able to use words in this way, too. It can help to look at the historical development of the Paschal celebration in the early centuries. I did that once back decades ago when I was studying patristic theology, and I was surprised to learn that Easter developed in different ways in different geographical locations where Christianity had been accepted. And one of the things that has passed out of our practice, but that I think is quite interesting, is that there were communities in Asia Minor that celebrated what we would call Easter, that celebrated Easter on the very day of Pascha itself, on the very day of Passover itself, rather than as we do now on the Sunday which follows the Jewish Passover. You know, that's how the Easter date is calculated. Pascha or Passover for Jews is the full moon after the spring equinox. And Easter is calculated for us Christians as the first Sunday after the full moon of the vernal equinox. And so rarely, but every now and then, the Sunday and Passover fall on the same day. But for centuries in Asia Minor, Christians celebrated Christian Pascha on the same day that Passover was celebrated. And this began to conflict with other parts of the church, which had begun to celebrate it on Sunday. Those that kept it on the same Jewish day had a very strongly developed sense of the feast that focused especially on chapter 12 of the book of Exodus. These people were called, by the way, quatrodecimans, which is a good word to learn. That's Christians. Christians that celebrate Easter, I'm misusing the language, but I want you to get my Christians that celebrate Easter on the same day as Jews celebrating Passover. They're quatrodecimans. Quatrodeciman simply means it's a Latin term for 14ers, because Passover falls on the 14th day of Nisan. And so, it was a pejorative term to put those people down. You guys are 14ers, you know, that's when you celebrate Easter. But anyway, if you say, you know, I'm not a quatrodeciman, people will be impressed with what you learned at Fellowship des Sud, you know. Okay, but here's the point. Quatrodecimans have a beautifully developed theological tradition. We have some of their preaching and Paschal teaching, primarily in homilies, and we can see that is a celebration very much marked by chapter 12 of the book of Exodus. And chapter 12 of the book of Exodus describes the prescriptions for the slaughtering and eating of the Paschal lamb. In that chapter, you'll recognize it as I summarize it for you. The Paschal Lamb's blood is to be spread on the doorposts and lintels of Israel's houses. They are to eat its roasted flesh together. And in the course of those prescriptions, we hear the Lord's own solemn word naming the feast and the meaning of the name of the feast. The Lord says, "This is the Pascha of the Lord." In English, we know that. This is the Passover of the Lord. You've heard that in solemnly proclaimed. This is the Passover of the Lord. But in Hebrew or in Greek or in Latin, it would read, "This is the Pascha of the Lord." And here's the definition of it. "For on this same night, I will go through Egypt, striking down every firstborn of the land." And then it adds, "But the blood will mark the houses where you are. Seeing the blood, I will pass over you." So in this sense, then, the word Passover or Pascha, in this sense, it's the Lord who passes. That's what it means. The Lord is passing and doing two things: passing through the land, striking down the firstborn, and passing the houses marked with the Lamb's blood. And because the Lamb's blood was what protected the houses of the Israelites, then this can be called Pasch as passion. Protection that is intimately connected with the slaughtering of the lamb. That's all in the Jewish mind. Christians who were struck by the fact that Jesus died and rose during Pascha, during the Jewish feast, and Quadragesimans who were remembering that annually on the very day of Passover were exposing themselves to this text in celebration. Those are the ancient texts we have. We have I'll give you his name. You can look it up. He's called Melito of Sardis. He was the bishop in Sardis. And Melito of Sardis is talking about this text at great length. And what is striking him is that it is all a prophecy of Christ. And we see that the images of this text are used to understand what was happening in Jesus' death. The images of the meal were strongly used by the Quadragesimans to understand the mystery of his death. That is to say, what's hidden in the death of Jesus? What do we have in Jesus' death? We have a slaughtered lamb. We have blood that protects. We have roasted flesh that the community is to eat together. So we understand that the Jewish Pascha is a prophecy of this new Pasch, which is Jesus' Pasch. And it is the very same day of the Jewish Pasch, Buona Pasqua. Okay? But what's the memory here? That the lamb has been slaughtered and his blood protects. Oh, wait a minute, what about resurrection? Why aren't you talking about that? Well, I'm presuming that. But that the focus is coming right down on how the lamb has been slaughtered and his blood protects, and we share the roasted flesh. That's how we know that he's risen. Because in that sharing, he is encountered as alive. That's the Quadragesiman tradition. Their celebration of Pasch very much emphasized the Lord's suffering and death, of which the Paschal Lamb was the supreme image. And Pasch for them was the memory and celebration of the Lord's glorious and life-giving death. That's what Pascha was, the memory of the Lord's glorious and life-giving death, where blood that saves us was shed, where from the cross the slaughtered lamb gives us his flesh to eat. And in my book, so that I can use this language for later, because we're only half done here, I summarize this by calling all this Pasch as Passion. But now I want to go on to a further meaning that is in the Jewish scriptures and that was also deeply assimilated by Christians. And that is the influence of chapter 14 of the book of Exodus. Chapter 14 of the book of Exodus recalls what happens after the destroying angel has passed. After the destroying angel has passed, the Israelites quickly get their act together and begin to leave. And as you know, they are pursued as far as the Red Sea, and then the sea is at first going to be the trap for the Israelites, and the sea is divided, and the Israelites pass over dry shod, and then the sea closes on the Egyptians who are pursuing them. We all know that story. This is a story, though. It's told in dramatic form in chapter 14 of the book of Exodus, and then chapter 15 says the whole thing again in poetic song. So both chapter 14 and 15 are beautiful celebrations of the scene at the sea. And the term Pasch was used for that as well, but here now it's not so much referring to the Lord passing through the land and passing over houses, but here it's the people passing, and it's the people passing out of Egypt into a safe land on the other side of the sea. And all this we can call Pasch as passage. Pasch as passage. So one is Pasch as passion, and the other is Pasch as passage. As I said, Christians were deeply struck by the fact that the Lord's death and resurrection took place deep inside the celebration of Passover, of Pasch. And as they're doing so, then they are going to also hear chapter 14 of the book of Exodus as a very strong sort of set of images with which we can understand what was happening in Jesus' own death and resurrection. And Jesus' death and resurrection then becomes a passage, as this one scriptural text says so clearly, from this world to the Father. This is John chapter 13, verse 1. Jesus, aware that his hour had come. His hour had come for what? For him to pass over from this world to the Father. Knowing everything that was to happen, rose from the table, and that's the way John introduces the text of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. We'll come back to that either in a subsequent conference or next year. But this is that's the gospel reading the night of Holy Thursday. And it's a prelude to the Lord washing the feet. That's a tremendous contrast. Jesus aware that his hour had come and that he was passing over from this world to the Father. What's he do? He gets up and gets down on the ground and starts washing their feet because his hour had come. Down he goes because his hour had come. It's dynamic tension of cross and resurrection. All right? It's all over the mystery of it. But one word for both sides of the water. Pasch for being in the house protected by blood. Pasch for fleeing out of Egypt. Pasch for being safe on the other side with the enemy destroyed. All that is Pasch. And if you just call the other side only Easter, well, then you're missing the point. Okay? So that's a long little interlude for us to be able to see something in the scriptural texts as they are celebrated in the church, namely this double-pronged meaning of Pasch. And why my point of this morning's conference, which was we have this one single huge event with many dimensions, we do have a term for the one single event. It's Paschal mystery. Okay? It's a great term for that reason. Okay? Now we can do a lot of theology. Let's put kind of a pause there and go on what in effect is another chapter of the book. But it's talking a little bit more about what we can call the crisis that the disciples experienced at the death of Jesus. The way I want to get into this is just by saying, you know, I build this as a retreat on the resurrection. And, you know, well, that sounds pretty good. Well, that will be a cheerful little retreat, won't it? You know, Jesus is risen from the dead. And, of course, it will be, but not in the way we might suspect. When I say resurrection, another way of saying that, of course, is the cross of Christ. The cross of Christ in whom is hid the Lord of glory. The one who is risen is the crucified Messiah. The resurrection opens the mystery of the cross and reveals the glory that is already contained in the Lord's death. We can misunderstand resurrection and think, oh, he's risen. Phew, I don't have to think about death. But not at all. The vantage point of resurrection is the only vantage point from which we can stand to look at the death of Christ and see all that God was doing and working in the six long hours of Jesus' agony. What is that about? How can we understand that in itself? No, it's resurrection itself, which I say opens and reveals the glory that is already contained in the Lord's death. But the death of Jesus was not understood by the disciples during the time that the events themselves were unfolding. Instead, the death of Jesus provoked an enormous crisis in the band of his disciples. We should think about the fact that we know about this crisis from people that are announcing to us the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. If you think about that, it's striking, because that the disciples all fled and abandoned Jesus, that Peter denied him three times, that they were hiding behind locked doors after the burial, that on the morning of resurrection, two of them were walking along toward Emmaus and were complaining about how disappointed they were in Jesus who'd been crucified. This is not information that unfortunately got out and put the disciples in a bad light. They're telling us this as they announce resurrection. They think it's part of the announcement of resurrection. The story of their crisis is part of the resurrection announcement. I don't think we think about that enough. I think it's, for me, this just strikes me deeply. And it gives me the courage to continually meditate on the mystery of the cross and what was happening there. One of the ways I put this with my students is that we need to remind ourselves that the perspective from which the Gospels are written is from resurrection to death, to resurrection. By which I mean that if in the chronological order of things, obviously, it's first cross and then resurrection. If that's how it happened, obviously. But in the telling of it, it's told from the perspective of resurrection. The cross is told and arriving at resurrection. This makes a big difference. In fact, the whole life of Jesus is told from the perspective of resurrection. And in fact, when you read the Gospels closely and well, this is what any deep study of the Scriptures will help us to understand, is that resurrection light is suffusing the whole story of Jesus from the moment of his birth, as that's recounted in Matthew and Luke, and all the way through his ministry in all four of the evangelists. And so that resurrection light tells us that something about what is significant in each of the four Gospels. And then, namely, each of the four Gospels spends the strongest amount of time in the Passion narratives. Why is that? Why so much time watching Jesus' trial and death? Because we need this, the Scriptures are telling us, to penetrate the mystery of resurrection. In talking in this way, I'm talking about what I like to call the deep structures of the mystery. Structures that we must seek to grasp if we're going to live our faith at depth. So, last night I mentioned this summary that we find in the Acts of the Apostles of the basic kerygma, the basic message. This Jesus whom you crucified, God has raised him up, and we are his witnesses. I think in previous retreats we spent some time working on this formula. And just let me review that for you, or for those that are new. What's useful about that formula is to notice a couple of different things. First of all, what scholars call the antithetical nature of the formula. There's a you and a God with Jesus in the middle. You did something to Jesus and God did something to Jesus. And this is the message being preached, that you crucified him. That's the way Jesus is preached. You know, it's not the kind of tactics we use today, but the theological point is that there is a common responsibility that we bear for the death of Jesus. That common responsibility is to anyone who hears the gospel must hear that I am accused of the death of Jesus. You crucified him, but God does something altogether different. But God raised him up. Human beings thought that in crucifying Jesus, they were doing what you do when you kill somebody. That's absolute, to kill someone. When you kill someone, you think you finished him. All right, that's it. I did that. It's different. You shoot someone in the foot so they'll leave or something, you know. But an absolute action. But God did something that was more absolute. Raised him from the dead. This is the fundamental announcement. So a common responsibility for the death of Jesus and God's reaction to that. And this occurs at eight different places in the Acts of the Apostles. This phrase repeats itself. That's how we can sort of confidently say this was the core of apostolic preaching. In four of the eight instances, we have the additional phrase, and we are his witnesses. That this is what we're testifying to. And so something is being proclaimed here about Jesus, and something also is being proclaimed about human beings. For Jesus, God's raising Jesus from the dead means that he lives, that he is exalted at God's right hand, that he has been vindicated as being who he claimed to be. To use the language of the scriptures, the Lord God establishes Jesus as Lord and Messiah, as Lord and Christ. These are glorious terms in Jewish language and also in Hellenistic language. Kurios, Lord. Caesar was called Kurios. No, Caesar's not Kurios. Jesus is Kurios. Who's the Messiah? Christos. Jesus is Messiah. No, he was crucified. Jesus is Messiah. The crucified is Messiah. God establishes him. You crucified him, proving he couldn't be the Messiah. But God established him as Kurios and Christos. That's his exaltation. That's what it means for Jesus. What does it mean for human beings? For Jesus, for human beings, it means the remission of sins, that we're not held responsible for the death of Jesus. We are, and we're not held responsible. The first word to those who deserted him of the risen Lord is shalom. Shalom. Peace. Forgiveness of sins, which is to say, you know, we think, oh yeah, sure, God forgives sins, he's nice. Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he? What's it mean to forgive sins? See, we've lost our sense of the horror of sin. Sin is what the world was absolutely trapped in before Jesus. It is humanity's refusal of a relationship with God, with all the consequences of that playing themselves out, all the way to death as the kingdom that reigns. But now, sins are forgiven. We are declared in Jesus, in his resurrection of the crucified, we are declared justified in the presence of God. God looks at us and says, not guilty. When we should be. But God really means it. Not guilty. And why? What was he doing on the cross? What was the work of the cross, the long hours of his dying? That was what it looks like for God to take sin and death into himself and still be God, which we said is still being love, still crying out, Abba, Father. Humanity did that. And so we really are not guilty. Because the sinless immortal one identified himself with us in sin and death, all the way to letting himself be put to death. But God raised him up. So, for human beings, the resurrection of Jesus means justification. It means being right with God. And it also means receiving a spirit-inspired mission of being witnesses to what God has done. Here, the dynamic tension between cross and resurrection is brought out very clearly. The realism of the resurrection is brought out by the realism of the death of Jesus. While the unfathomable effect of resurrection invites us to interpret the death of Jesus at a much more profound level. I said earlier, we cannot enter into the depths of what Jesus' death was doing except but from the perspective of resurrection. So both death and resurrection together constitute the apostolic proclamation. One of my great teachers from my Roman past used to speak about all these things and say, in Christianity, God has revealed to us a new name. He says, the new name of God, it's a long one, the new name of God is the one who raised Jesus from the dead. This is, how can we as Christians think of God and think of anything other than that? That's who God is. And the one, God is the one who raised God's own Son, who is God, from the dead. But that's God's new name. So, with that phrase, let's move with that phrase now, and all that it can mean, I hope. The phrase, you crucified him, but God raised him up, and we are his witnesses. Let's move now into a deeper understanding of the cross from that perspective. And we can do that, I think, by looking at the crisis that the cross of Christ provoked in the community of his disciples. The shock that the disciples of Jesus experienced at his death was enormous. Though we see him in the course of his ministry trying to teach them about it, he does so unsuccessfully. And with hindsight, we can say that his language and actions in the Last Supper were also profound teachings about the cross. He was quite literally already on the cross in the supper. By which I mean his intention was being revealed to let himself be given over. That's how the supper has the cross in it. Okay? That's where the cross really gets underway. In any case, so Jesus is teaching, we could say, without immediate fruits, what the meaning of the cross is. And so what we see instead in the disciples is an enormous crisis when Jesus is taken and when he dies that way. It's enough for us to recall how some of the evangelists tell the story of the mocking that Jesus experienced on the cross. There was a lot of theology in the mocking. The theology was, if you're the Messiah, come down. Because no other Messiah could be conceived. They were mocking him because you said you're the Messiah. You are being abandoned by God. Proof, you're dying that way. You're dying without God. They were making him feel it. That's what crucifixion was. It was invented by the Romans as a cruel way to, in detail, humiliate a human being at length. You are nothing. God, there's no theological categories for Jews to say, that must be the Messiah. No, he couldn't be the Messiah if God abandoned him to that. This is the crisis that was provoked in the disciples of Jesus who were convinced that he was the Messiah. Boy, were we wrong. This is their experience, okay? The story of this crisis, I repeat, is part of the narrative of those who are telling us about resurrection. So they think that for us to understand resurrection, we need to understand that they were in crisis. I think about this a lot. I've thought about this for years. This is what celebrating Eucharist causes me to think about. This is what studying and meditating on death and resurrection causes me to think about. And I have found that a good way to sort of enter into the nature of the crisis was to realize that it provoked in the disciples three enormous theological questions. And the three questions are these. Given the death of Jesus, then first question, who is God? Second question, who is Jesus? And third question, and who are we? Who is God? Who is God if he could have abandoned somebody like Jesus? Jesus, who had lived his whole life in a faithful turning toward the Father, in a faithful and powerful announcing of the presence of the kingdom of God. Who is God if he abandons a man like that to such a shameful death? Second question, who is Jesus? Who is Jesus who saw this hour coming and walked toward it? These remarkable words of his, no one takes my life from me. I have the power to lay it down and the power to take it up again. This command I have received from my Father. That's how Jesus goes to his death. Or what he was doing in the supper the night before he died. He was going to his death. Take this, all of you, and eat it, for this is my body given up for you. Take this, all of you, and drink it, for this is the cup of my blood, the blood of a new and eternal covenant, which will be poured out for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this in memory of me. Who was Jesus who died that way? And then who are we? The disciples had to have asked themselves. Who are we? What is to become of us now that Jesus is dead? All the primary relationships of their lives were put into question. Jesus had given them a new relationship with God. He's gone. They'd given him a new relationship with himself. He's dead. He had given them a relationship among each other. He's dead. There's nothing for them to do but disband. So these are the questions that the disciples felt before the resurrection. And I repeat, they tell us of this crisis as part of their narrative of the resurrection. I think they're telling us of this because I think no one can arrive at resurrection faith without in some way passing through the same crisis of questioning. I think we have to ask these questions. Who is God if the cross is how he saves us? And who is Jesus who with total trust went that way? And who are we without Jesus? And who would we be with Jesus if, in fact, the Father has raised him up? So I'll let you live in that tension of that crisis, and we shall come back and move further into it this evening. Thank you.
When faith is frail, you